Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
At Sleep Outfitters Outlet, great sleep is a big deal. Save 40 to 60% every day on every Sealy, Stearns & Foster, and Tempur-Pedic. Queens as low as $249. Customer exchanges, closeouts, and floor samples. Inventory changes daily, so come in for your dream deal today. With no credit needed financing, expert advice, and up to 60% off retail, it's never been easier to get the sleep and savings you deserve. Go to sleepoutfittersoutlet.com for financing details and to find a store near you.
Trying to grab all the groceries in one trip? Oof, not how you would have done that. You know sometimes less is more. Like when you drive less and save with the USAA annual mileage discount. USAA, get a quote today.
When I think about the track, it's so bizarre, really. And I didn't realize that it was bizarre at the time, but we had nothing to lose. And we didn't really care what people thought.
We bought a model agency one, we thought at one point.
Can you imagine?
Yeah, we bought this model agency. Well, we were convinced we knew what we were doing. And yeah. We lost a ton of money on that. We started getting beaten up and hit pretty quickly after that event. And then we just, because we've worked in Russia and the East before, you can't argue with these people because you will get a beating and the coppers won't intervene. They'll let it happen.
Really an amazing pleasure because it takes me back to my sort of heyday on MTV, which is wonderful. So I'm thrilled to be here with both of you today. And we're all of a similar age. So, you know, can be nice and honest and talk about our lives in a really hopefully honest and open way. One thing I wanted to talk to you about was really about your, when you were growing up, and what sort of music did your parents listen to? And what sort of music did you then start listening to? How did you react against their taste?
No, I didn't listen to any music.
Mum listened to Dean Martin.
Yeah.
Frank Sinatra, Trini Lopez.
Glenn Miller.
Then we got some friends of theirs who now looking back, I think was a gay couple. But at the time, you just... because I was a kid, I thought just mates, but they went, these two guys went traveling. Oh. And, sorry, there's a top of the door. And they left us with a huge collection of records, at which point I got into early Motown, early Stones, a little bit of Beatles. So that was what we were, when we were very young, that's what we grew up on. And then after that, I started getting into, well, we both did. We got into rock initially. We were Deep Purple fans.
Led Zepp.
Yardbirds I liked. Creedence. And then I think through the 70s, we started discovering a bit of electronica. The whole New York scene. I thought bands like Television I liked a lot.
What about personally music? What music did, were you pushed into learning music? I mean, yeah. I remember as a kid, my mum, you know, bought a piano and then off I went and had piano lessons. By the time I was 12, she sold it because I was so bad.
Okay.
But no, were you sort of brought up in a way that they wanted you to play music? They wanted you to learn music?
Not at all. No.
So how did that come about?
Well, we sort of slid into it, really. I mean, Fred started playing guitar when he was how old?
11 or 12.
About 11 or 12. Mm-hmm. And writing songs. And I remember thinking, and he would pass the ideas past me, kind of thing, just to see what I thought. And I remember thinking that some of them were pretty good and some of the lyrics were good. And then we just, and I think really the prospect of any ordinary job didn't really appeal to us, to be honest with you. You know, I couldn't see myself doing we don't take orders very well, which is why we have a big problem with what's going on right now. So we tended to search out an alternative way of living. We initially ran a gym in Putney, but prior to that, we had been doing gigs. We started doing gigs in London in the mid to late 70s.
Mm, we did a lot of manual labour.
Yeah, but it was voluntary, really. It was a bit like joining the services. What I liked about it was you met people that you wouldn't normally meet in any other way, any other walk of life. You know, you met all sorts of weird and wonderful people doing that.
And what did your mother think of you actually sort of pursuing at the start? I mean, not just playing music at home and playing the guitar, Fred, but sort of also then making a decision and saying, okay, we're going to sort of pursue this in some way. Because I could imagine that my parents would have sort of looked at me and sort of laughed, you know.
Yes, I mean, I remember being taken for a walk by Dad, and this was probably about 3 years before the band, 3 or 4 years before the band took off, because he died before the band happened, so he never saw it. But he took me for a walk, and he was just sort of fishy about, you know, how old you are and have you made any money and what you plan to do with your life. And that kind of, he wasn't saying don't do this or do that. He wasn't being, you know, confrontational in any way. He was just curious to find out what we were thinking. And of course, you know, we were both in our early 30s when the band broke. And
late bloomers.
Yeah, we were late bloomers. So, you know, for mum and dad, I think it was a pretty worrying time. Mm. You know,
they were both quite tolerant because mum was a good dancer, but mum grew up in poverty, and so single parent back in the 30s, late 20s and 30s was quite a big deal back then, and they were always running from landlords. She told us how she used to live and
hiding behind the sofa when the rent man came.
Yeah. I mean, the whole staff and you know, the sharing clothes with her sister, and you know, not always a lot of food on the table. Dad came from a bit of money. But after the war, Second World War, he wanted to be a farmer, couldn't, so he became a printer. So they both didn't do what they passionately wanted to do. They both had been forced or driven into not fulfilling their dreams. So when they saw us trying to fulfill our dream, I think they were more passionate, more patient than they otherwise would have been.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting perception, because I think parents of our generation, which were war parents, you know, they didn't get the opportunities that we did. So they saw it completely different.
They did very much so. Yeah.
Sorry, Richard, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, no, and I think they were much more, as Fred says, they were much more patient with us. One of the things I can remember really clearly, Dad worked in London, so he was taking the train to and from London for sort of 30 years, on and off, 40 years. And on one occasion, you know, he struggled through the tube and through on the train with an acoustic guitar. In a huge cardboard box that must have been an absolute bloody nightmare, you know, to carry with all the, you know, the crush of people. But here, there was that level of support there.
Yes, there was.
One of the things back in the day, which was surprising to me, was when they were at school, when they were trying to teach you, you know, music appreciation and how to play the piano or whatever it was, they never really made it clear that you could make money at it.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you can play the piano, you don't even have to read. But if you can play the piano, you can earn money in a pub pretty much anywhere in the world.
We used to be able to.
Yeah. So there was, I think Dad was of that opinion. He it was a jolly good to be in play music and all that kind of stuff. But when it comes to earning money, you're going to have to knuckle down and do a job. I think deep down, that's what he thought.
Well, I had a teacher at school. Physics teacher who slapped me around the back of the head because I was waiting for the class to open. I took my guitar to school a lot so I could practice in breaks and stuff. And I was sitting there playing, And he's, you know, stupid. You can see I'm holding a guitar and playing. He said, "What are you doing, Fairbrass?" So I'm playing my guitar. And he said, "You can't make any money out of that." I said, "Well, Paul McCartney does." He went, bang! Smack me around the head. Yes.
I hope he lived long enough. That's all I can say. I really do. Because then he might think differently. The first band that I read about was The Actors. Now, I've been trying to look and find anything on The Actors, and I couldn't find anything. What sort of band was it, and what sort of music did you play back then?
The Actors was sort of, it was pop, but it was a little bit odd. We had a very, very good guitar player called Mike Gerrard. So we gave him the room to be quite experimental, and we did quite long instrumental sections. And it was quite energetic most of the time.
Sort of power poppy.
A little bit power poppy, yeah. But with sort of moments of instrumentals thrown in. So our first tour was 1978, and we were on the road with Suicide, who were a New York duo, electronic duo. And through that, we did gigs with Joy Division, yeah. And I think The Addicts and some other bands, but we never really fitted in. We were upbeat but not punky, and the whole Thames beat and power pop thing
passed us by.
So we had a lot of interest. We got picked up by various little independent labels where nothing happened. Then we got some very good reviews, and basically the thing just petered out after about 3 years.
Yeah.
And then Richard and I picked up. But then we went, moved to London pretty much, and then we started just writing with other people, playing other bands. So we've got a lot of memorabilia from The Actors. We've got
posters
and quite an extensive gig sheet.
Yeah,
and we did, you know, the Nashville, the Marquee, Hope and Anchor.
Yeah,
we did pretty much all the main gigs in London and
colleges,
you know. So we did that, and then we just morphed from one band to another. We were in and out of record deals all through the 80s, some appalling, and I'm pleased they just didn't happen. And then the biggest deal we signed was Capital EMI in America, New York. And again, that just didn't happen. The money disappeared into somebody's back pocket. We completed the sort of album demos, but we never even started the album. The money just went.
Yeah.
So at which point, this is like 1987, 88, which point we just think, we're not interested in a record deal. Fuck these people.
We got really bored of the idea.
Yeah, I got tired of asking for permission. I got tired of waiting for them. So we just said, look, so that was the idea. When we eventually recorded Don't Be Sexy, the whole point of that was, and us meeting, hooking up with Rob Manzoli, was to let's write a song that none of us had written before. So we, all your ideas we don't want to hear, and all our ideas you're not going to hear. Let's write a brand new song. So
can I take you back a bit though before we get to that?
Because
I want to go back to the era where, you know, where you were on stage and you toured and you were supporting Suicide, and you were, you know, and these really, you know, big artists. I mean, Suicide was a very instrumental artist in terms of electronic music. You know, people back and absolutely
groundbreaking.
They were really groundbreaking. Did you learn from them, and what do you feel that they may have gleaned from you? Because people always say what they learn from other people, but they never ever offer what they feel like other people may have taken from them.
I had never experienced electronic music until I heard Suicide. I didn't know anything about it.
It was a head fuck, wasn't it?
It really was, and I didn't like it. I thought it was far too loud, and I don't know. I suppose I was a bit out of place, really, because we came from the countryside, a very sort of conservative town, and then we were mixing with all these alternative type people, and
very, I didn't art house,
truly understand what was going on. I don't think that I would, unless Fred, you know, says different, I don't think they gleaned anything from us at all. The one thing that I gleaned from them was volume. That's what I got, and the importance of the bass end. I suddenly was really aware of that.
But okay, tell me about that. What is the importance of the bass end? What is important?
Well, it's the bass.
It's a frequency. The
sub bass that they use. And also the bass as an instrument can colour a track completely. It can define the personality of a track much more than I thought it could. And I can remember we did a gig in Leeds, I think, and the gig was in this rather isolated kind of club that I seem to remember. And we had gone off after the sound check to get a bite to eat, and we were walking back to the gig. And 50 yards from the gig, you could hear this this noise. And that's when I suddenly thought, I'd never experienced it before. I didn't, because all the, you know, all the bass players that I've grown up with, Paul McCartney or, you know, Bill Wyman or whatever, you know, that whole sub-bass thing was new to us, completely new to us.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
So I think we learned, the one thing that I think other people can learn from us, the only thing is perseverance.
Well, I think that's what...
I think that's the one thing.
I think that's what we got from Suicide. They've got a lot of friction from the audiences. Most of the audiences were pretty hostile to them, and they just stood their ground. They did not flinch. Alan Vega was just... I didn't realise at the time, but he was a pretty ballsy guy. And he would just get on and do his thing. And sometimes they went along to a script to a certain degree. He stuck to the song, but he also, because the relentless groove and keyboards that Marty Rever set up, they were really uncompromising, completely. And basically, he wouldn't take any shit.
No,
wasn't a big guy, but he wouldn't take any shit from anybody.
A bit like that clip of Twisted Sister.
Yeah, yeah.
Where the guy just goes completely.
Yeah, at Reading, I think. I admire bands like, whether I like their music or not, it's irrelevant. But I admire these bands that just, this is what we do. If you don't like it, fine.
Yeah.
If you do like it, great.
You have to be like that.
There's not much, there was very little compromise. I don't think they learned anything from us. But one thing also I learned from them is that musicians should stick together, because we got screwed on the tour a couple of times.
Mm.
And they put their foot down and they said, the band needs a hotel room. Find one. They were very adamant about that. You can't.
When you say the band needs a hotel room, didn't the band have a hotel room? What were they thinking? Where the fuck are you going to sleep?
In the van.
In the van. There was no room in the van because the van was full of Suicide's gear. Part of the deal was we were the support band, the roadies,
and the PA
hire guys.
Yeah.
So we supplied everything, and that's how we got the tour. So we couldn't have slept in the van if we wanted to, because all the shit was in there. So they were very adamant. They said, you can't not put these boys in a fucking hotel room, you know. And they were very adamant about that. And one day we didn't get paid. So between them and our drummer, Tommy O'Donnell, who was also very
ballsy.
They just went into the promoter's office and threatened him, basically, and the money appeared.
And you learn on the circuit when we started off. You have to develop a thick skin, and you have to develop, you know, a fairly aggressive attitude, if only in self defence, because everybody's out to. I mean, at one gig, I shan't name where it is, but the landlord was arrested. Because if they found all the lots of bands that had been playing down there, half their gear was up in his bedroom.
He was nicking it.
He was nicking it. Well,
and clothes.
And clothes.
Yeah.
So, you know,
we're getting to the core of what was behind it now.
Yeah. You have to, when you leave the stage after sound check, you have to take all your pedals with you in case they get nicked.
Occasionally we get an encore. In the early days, occasionally. And we're at the Rock Garden, we got an encore. When I walk back on, all my pedals are gone.
Yeah.
Someone had just leaned over and nicked all my pedals.
Yeah.
And just fucking walked out of the club.
Yeah.
And so we grew a fairly aggressive attitude towards the industry. We were quite trusting to begin with, and still too trusting for years, a few years after that. But overall, we're fairly cynical and we're quite aggressive in certain situations. If we think people are just taking the piss, then we have explained to them in no uncertain terms that could end very badly for them. So we have gone down that road a couple of times, because we won't be fucked around like that.
I think that's why management has always had trouble. That's why we haven't really settled with management ever.
Yeah.
Because management rarely, or the management we've had, rarely sees things as we do, and that's where the friction.
And they're compromised.
People and management are always. Everybody's compromised one way or the other.
Yeah.
So, and we had one guy, I think, who was charging us for flights to go and do some business on our behalf to Germany or wherever it was. And then we found out he was also doing business for about four other bands.
Probably charging them.
And charging them too. So, you know, you just live and learn. That's it.
Yeah, well, I think the music industry for a long, long period, and maybe even today, because I'm not that associated with it anymore, but for a long, long period was very corrupt. It always reminded me of my father, who was a market trader. And, you know, and behind the market trader, there were always friends of his who were would disappear.
Yes.
We'd never know whatever happened to the man with the teddy bears down the road. And all these sort of things.
One of the things very briefly is that because back in the day, there was a load of money swilling around in the business, you know, one way or the other, with tours and massive sales, all that kind of stuff. So it attracted a whole load of fairly unpleasant people who thought they could make a killing fairly quickly. Mm. The music industry does not have that money anymore, anything like it used to. And bands certainly don't, because the sales have dropped and touring is much more difficult and expensive than it ever was. So it's probably not a bad time now in terms of, you know, anybody that was in the business for the wrong reasons has probably, you know, gone into something else now. I don't know what, you know. So I don't know.
We hope so.
Yeah, we would hope so. The business doesn't need people like that. But generally speaking, you know, I think most bands live and learn. Every band gets ripped off in one way or the other. Mm. Our story is not particularly unique, you know.
No, it's not.
Yeah, well, I think one thing that is unique about it is that you cut your teeth over the years in various areas, like Richard as a session musician.
Yeah.
And maybe you can tell me what a session musician, I can't even say the word, what a session musician really does. Are they just there to actually play what the artist wants, or do they contribute in some way?
Well, I mean, the only way I play, I mean, I'm slow, so I'm not the most, economically viable session musician out there, you know. And I wouldn't want to do anything where I couldn't put ideas in. I mean, that's the enjoyable part. I think it depends what kind of, I imagine if you're the bass player with Steely Dan, you know, it's note by note by note, and you missed a quaver there, so can we do it again, and all that, you know, that's my impression. Whereas if you're, if you're the bass player with Lou Reed or somebody, then it's probably a little bit looser. Yeah. It depends on the act, but I wouldn't, you know, I enjoy coming up with ideas. So it just, you know, just being instructed to do this or to do that would not appeal to me greatly.
So yeah, what did you bring to Boy George? What did you bring to Mick Jagger?
Well, the Mick Jagger stuff we both did, and that wasn't they weren't studio sessions; they were promo sessions.
Yeah.
They were promo gigs, and same with David Bowie. But the stuff I did with Dylan was live. So that was just basically playing what had already been pre-recorded on tracks. They just wanted the track to sound the same. So I was the second guitar player. Red Beach was the first guitar one. So I was basically doing rhythm parts, pretty basic stuff, really. And we were never in the studio. We were never hired in studios because people wanted to hear our ideas. That never happened. And it does. We have used a lot of session players. And they are generally incredibly competent musicians. Rarely are they very inventive. They tend to have a way of playing or approach to music that's quite conservative. You get exceptions like Phil Spaulding, who played bass with us. He was very inventive. We had a drummer called Chuck Saber, very inventive guy. Most of the guitar players we've worked with are very conservative and, you know, don't really think outside the box. But we've been blessed. We've worked with some very, very good players. But in terms of invention, there's only a handful who've been very inventive.
I think in actual fact, we learned more from that experience working with those people.
Yes. Yeah.
We learned more from that than we did from, you know, doing the stuff with the band in the early days.
What did you learn?
Well, I learned that basically there's nothing particularly unique about it. There's nothing particularly, these people are all people.
Yeah.
That's what they are. David Bowie was just a bloke, you know? And so, you know, when people get, I've never had a hero ever in my life, you know, because I recognize the simple fact that they're all people. And as Bob Dylan said, even the president of the United States has to stand naked at some point. So once you get that in your head, and I remember when I did the Bowie thing, I walked past his Winnebago and he was standing there in his underpants. And I just remember thinking, well, it's a bloke. It's just a bloke.
Yeah.
You know, and they would, I don't think David Bowie was like this, but there are certain stars out there who want us to believe there's something close to the angels, something close to God. They're not, they're just people. And some people, some of them are immensely gifted and some of them are less gifted,
yeah,
but they are just people. Yeah.
We did a show with James Brown in Boston, and the limo drove up the side of the stage and he came out and became James Brown for 20 minutes. And same thing, he was just this guy, just this dude had been around a long time. He's got this brilliant legacy. He had a green suit and he did 20 minutes. The band played about an hour and a half, but he only did 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And he was just a bloke and he said hi and bye and that. Do you know what I mean? He was just this guy who happens to be quite brilliant. Mm. And I think that's what we've discovered. We've done a lot of shows with a lot of different bands and, you know, all sorts of people. And met lots of famous sort of people. Most of them are just regular people. And most of them are quite nice. The egos and stuff tend to happen, in our experience, tend to happen further down the food chain, particularly bands that have been put together as a project, where in fact they have no control because that's the deal, that's the nature of their deal. And they tend to be a little bit more egotistical and defensive.
And demanding,
because I think they know that in reality, they're not actually in control at all.
Well, it's the Spinal Tap moment, isn't it? The meat doesn't fit the role.
Yes.
You know, it's that,
yeah,
the sandwich, you know, yeah. He's obsessed with the meat fitting the role because that's where the only power he's got.
Left,
you know, because there's a whole bunch of people around you telling you where to go, what to do. Mm. And also, we've never been dazzled by the fame thing, particularly. We've always not seen through it. That implies that we're special. But no, it's just... We just didn't like it, really. You know, the red carpet thing and... I don't know. We just weren't. I remember once we were invited to a big red carpet thing and John Travolta was there and the whole thing, you know. And we get there, Leicester Square, back in the day, hundreds and hundreds of people, you know, the red carpet and the theatre, lights everywhere. And we got there and simultaneously our hearts just sunk. It was like, oh, this is going to be awful. We didn't think, oh, hey, this is going to be great. So we went up, there's a pub just up the road from Leicester Square, and we went and got bladdered in there and completely, and then we managed to do it.
Yeah, we did, yeah. Yeah, we're drunk.
So, I love that red carpet thing, because sometimes people walk up here and they don't get noticed. So they sit around the back and then they do it again.
Try it again.
And then you think, oh, my God, that's so sad.
Yeah, it is really sad.
But do you think then, like, the image that
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The music industry can build up for you, whether it's a record company or whether it's, I don't know, from your own management, can be a dangerous thing for your own life.
Oh, completely.
Yeah, very much so. And also you start to think, first of all, you think it's very easy to forget you're self-employed and you actually are in control of your own destiny, because record labels and managers have no interest in letting you know that. So what happened with us when we had no intention of becoming famous or being celebrities. We just wanted to put a record out, which was I'm Too Sexy. That was it. And the nature of that record took us into very much a celebrity world, very much Saturday night, Friday night TV, tabloids. We didn't know it was going to happen. We never talked about it. Never mentioned it once.
I think we thought everybody did it. This is the business. This is what it is. And then, you know, gradually you realize over time, actually, you don't have to get up at 5 a.m. to do some cookery thing, you know, on TV in the morning. You don't, you know, if it's not part of what you are, it's really, really important to know who you are and not get sidetracked by the people around you.
We definitely got sidetracked.
And we got sidetracked in for the first 4 or 5 years. We were definitely sidetracked.
I mean, one of the things about I'm Too Sexy, you've mentioned it already, is the bass line, is that, you know, there's a strong bass in it. The other thing is that you had a period of living in New York, which I think contributed to the idea. Very and also so. The fact that I don't know whether you owned a gym or you were working in a gym, but you're working in a gym. And and also that working in the gym contributed to the idea. Can you put all those things together and tell me about how that really came up over those years?
Well, the New York thing, we went to New York to become famous. You know, that's where,
get a deal.
Get a deal and
do
all
something.
That. Do something. New York was really good for us, I think, looking back. Because we were on our own. We had mum and dad were not there to rescue us. We were on our own. We were living in a crack house, basically. And working, you know, I was working in a gym. Fred was working in some dodgy cafe downtown.
I was working on in Astor Place.
In Astor Place. Yeah, yeah. So it put us on our mettle a little bit. And I think we became much more independently minded. And a little bit more aggressive, I think. New York doesn't take prisoners back.
It was just pre Giuliani, so it was very. It was still, you know, the rotten apple, if you like. It was very loads of violence on the streets. It was very fast paced. It wasn't in the slightest bit empathetic to how you were feeling that day.
No.
And we learned the hard way. We came across some pretty scary people. And we just thought, well, we got back that. Richard worked in Nell's, which was a very famous club. Richard worked in the gym. I worked in Art Cafe and somewhere else. And these were all quite, the Art Cafe I worked in was sort of where a lot of the traders would come and drink and eat. Lots of beautiful people floating around and stuff. And also we got involved in, well, we met quite a few sort of, not celebs, but the nightclub people, you know, that lot. And so Sexy came out of that. There were these people that were basically too sexy for their shirt.
Yeah, yeah.
Then when we got back to the UK, we worked in the gym. And so you come across a lot of hedonism, narcissism. And that's partly when we started writing the lyrics, that's what we fed off. We just thought this is what this is about, you know.
Well, I think.
And you threw away all the tracks in the past. You said that earlier, that you decided you didn't want to do anything you'd done before. You wanted to do something completely different.
Yes.
That's pretty much, we did the chorus of Deeply Dippy. Oh my, I love that one. Well, that's an old chorus we had from a previous song.
Trying to grab all the groceries in one trip? Oof, not how you would have done that. You know sometimes less is more. Like when you drive less and save with the USAA annual mileage discount. USAA, get a quote today.
And that just happened to fit that song. So we did, we rescued that. But everything else was brand new. Yeah.
One of the things that's weird, I think, is that people say to us, oh, you know, when it comes to this whole COVID thing, oh, you know, we're really surprised you guys are speaking out, you know, because I'm too sexy, you look so... I think people assume that we were going to be either stupid or pliant or something. But actually, you don't make a record like I'm Too Sexy if you're obsessed with what people think.
No, you don't, no.
You just don't. Because when I think about the track, it's so bizarre, really. And I didn't realise that it was bizarre at the time, but we had nothing to lose. And we didn't really care what people thought.
It was obviously ironic, but then I'm English. So sort of see the irony. But I can imagine in America at that time, but maybe it was seen as something else because irony doesn't really exist so much.
No, it doesn't. I mean,
the Americans were overall way more supportive than the music industry and the media in America were way more supportive than the UK. From the very off, we had endless problems with the media and certainly the music business. Music business couldn't fucking stand us.
I can see why now.
I think it was partly because they knew they'd all thrown away the opportunity to sign a very lucrative song. I think that annoyed them that we proved them to be so wrong. And also it was because we called them out. We were pretty not unpleasant. What's the word? We weren't in awe of them at all. And once Sexy kicked off, when Sexy was massive, we still weren't signed. It was only a letter of intent. It was an email of intent. And suddenly Sony and the rest of the sort of it bods steamed in with crazy money to lure us away. We said, well, you didn't want it in the first place. Why do you want it now? So it's clearly not a musical decision. You just want the money. So we stuck with the independent label, which was a good idea and a bad idea equally.
Yeah.
But it dawned on us very quickly how we weren't that popular with the industry, because when we went to the Brits in 93 or was it two?
Three, I think.
Two or three, can't remember. No, two, it was two.
Was it two?
And we were clearly the breakout band of that year. We clearly were. We had number one in America, and they just blanked us. Brits just blanked us. So at that point, I just thought, okay, we're not part of the BPI with this record label. We don't fit. This is how this is going to go.
I think it's the fitting thing.
Yeah.
I think it's the fitting thing. We just, we weren't pretty. We weren't 22. We didn't dance. Do you know what I mean? We just, we were a bit mouthy. Mm. I just think and the track that I'm Too Sexy was a bit of some. It's a Marmite track. You either love it or you hate it. It's one of those things. We weren't mainstream. So I think, one of the interesting things, for instance, we just had this number one in America just recently with Drake. All the interview requests and all the interest came from the States. We haven't had one interview request from any of the media in the UK.
Won't touch us.
But
we've had Rolling Stone, Billboard, TMZ. I mean, loads of stuff in America.
I want to come to that later, because there is this like turn in your career, and part it's to do with Taylor Swift, it's to do with Jay-Z, it's to do with being played in certain movies and so on and so forth. Yeah. But suddenly there's been a sort of turn where it's almost like the credibility that you never felt is somehow coming back, today. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's sort of being paid back today. Yeah. But you talked about that, when I'm Too Sexy came out and that video came out. And it was absolutely massive. And you said before the big labels were trying to get you. Exactly. You'd only signed a sort of email letter of intent or whatever it would be called.
Exactly right.
Do you think that there were so many people that didn't believe in you? This is what I've read. And one of them was, and this was presumably a friend. Do you remember Jake from Browns? And apparently he bet you that if you got to number one, he'd give you a free party, because my mate at that time used to work on Top of the Pops, or she went in to do makeup for one of the people on Top of the Pops, and you invited her to the party. And she told me about it today and said, Jake had said, because we used to go there, Jake had said, you're never going to get to number one with that. You're never getting anywhere with that. And so he had to eat his words. Yeah. Were there a lot of people that ate humble pie because of the success of that track?
I think if they did, they didn't do any eating in front of us.
No.
they kept it very private.
Exactly. Even the record label that we ended up working with, which was Targ Records, they didn't like us either. And they
everybody hated us.
Part of the reason is because Richard and I are just difficult to a degree to work with, because we say what we think all the time. For example, when you're shooting a video, I'm sure other bands have noticed this, record companies don't bother turning up first thing in the morning, because all they want to turn up is for lunch, when the lunch turns up at 1 o'clock, or the evening meal. And we never really I'm sure some bands have, they've experienced great A&R guys and really good label managers. And
they are out there.
They are out there. We just personally never have.
Yeah.
The record label we worked with was just poisonous and hot. An independent, you think they'd act a bit more altruistically, but that was beyond them. And they were equally then what happened was, sorry, go back. The reason, I think part of the reason was, is that we eventually signed a record deal on the back of I'm Too Sexy, Don't Talk, Just Kiss, and the pre-sales of the first album. So we were in a very powerful position. And we, as I understand it, our lawyer beat them up royally. And they they kept that with them. They wanted to screw us over one way or another, which they did. And I think I think in the record labels, what annoys a lot of record company people is they don't get validation. And I'm sure some deserve it because some have got good ears, some do put good projects together, and there have been some very good guys in the music business, of course. But I think, you know, if you take a band who probably isn't that talented, like a boy band or girl band, and it's probably the people behind them who have the talent. It's maybe a Simon Fuller or whoever, right. And they're the people with the vision, but they don't get the recognition. I think there's a bit of spite and malice and jealousy that goes on. The wrong people are getting the credit. I think that happens in the music business a lot.
There's also the pretense that everybody knows what they're doing.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And the truth is, it's a horse race.
Yeah,
that's the truth. Yeah.
And it's a bit of a cliche, isn't it? It's a bit like if you can't do, you work in the record company. You know what I mean? I think there's some truth in a cliche.
They try to sort of mathematize it, if you like, you know, with odds and midweeks, and they try and turn it into numbers. And everybody's pretending, you know, bands pretend that they know what's going on. The management pretends that they know what's going on. The record label pretends that they know what's going on. And the whole thing is a bit of an illusion, really. Mm. And very often when things do take off and when we had some big success in Germany, everything is trying to catch up. It's not a question, you know what I mean? It's not a question that this is all planned. It's, oh my God, it's gone number two. Oh my God. And suddenly there's this, oh my God, you know. there's always this sense of panic and innocence in a funny kind of way, you know. But we're happier now than we've ever been, to be honest.
Yeah, overall we are. I mean,
financially it's a bit of a headache, but...
financially it's
not. Oh, come on, Drake. That must help.
No, but that won't happen until next year.
Yeah, and also the royalties aren't what they were. They just aren't. I mean, as fabulous as the Taylor Swift thing was, it's nothing compared to the numbers we saw in the 90s. Just nothing. So, no complaints still. We've been incredibly fortunate, and God bless Taylor Swift and Drake.
Exactly.
But did you actually invest your money at the time? Did you actually do, or were you like me?
No, we've
been relatively careful.
Yeah, we invested, but we've also been, the trouble is when we invest in ourselves, which we do
all the time,
we aren't, quite often our heart gets in the way of our head. So we will invest too much money in ourselves, in like an album project or something. We bought a model agency
Can you imagine?
Yeah, we bought this model agency. Well, we were convinced we knew what we were doing, and we lost a ton of money on that.
Yeah,
and we've done other projects that we do.
I'm not sure that was a heart decision.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I think there's an ulterior motive going on there.
Yeah.
And we did some other stuff. We just invested in albums on our own label we got carried away with got sidetracked by the music, and we forgot that we actually should have a budget on this. So on that note, my heart does go out to loads of record companies, because they have a hell of a job to make ends meet. It seems like they don't, but I know, having run our own label, it's bloody hard. So, you know, it's easy to criticize these people, which I do, but also they do have it's a tough gig.
It is.
How did you deal with fame at the beginning? Because it was an explosion. It wasn't just, you know, a slow progress to being famous. You were
not
like...
Not very well, I don't think.
Not very well.
No. Tell me what it was like. Give me some idea.
I have one memory in my head, and I was living in Putney. I was in Robert Dias buying, I don't know, a bag of nails or something. I don't know what I was buying. And... suddenly there was like dozens and dozens of people looking through the glass at the, you know, outside from the pavement. And I just thought the building was on fire. What are they looking at? I don't understand. What are they looking at? And then I realized it was me. And I ran out the back. And that's when it first began to dawn on me, I think. But we never, we only, I think, became truly aware of it when it was over. When we were looking at it,
we're in the eye of the storm.
When you're in the eye of the storm, you don't really see it. It's only when we were, you know, a few years later, and I thought, you know, when we met the Queen and all that kind of stuff, I look back and I think, my God, it really actually was. When I think of the money that I spent on my first house, doing up the bedroom, the curtains for 14 grand, are you kidding me? that sort of stuff sticks with me a lot.
I mean, one thing about being in the public eye. Now, I had it on a very low level being a presenter on MTV, but I was in the public eye. And because I'm a gay man, and I know that you're bisexual, that I'm a gay man. Yeah. And that was something that came up. Are you allowed to be gay on MTV? And this was in a, this was in 1987. This was in an era where it was much less acceptable.
Right.
And I didn't really want my private life out in the public. And I remember going to the MTV launch party in Amsterdam and the News of the World, you remember that, News of the Spring, yeah. They come up to me and they said, we know all about you. And walked off. And I thought, oh, shit, do they know? I thought, do they know something I don't know? Yeah, and yeah. And for you, it suddenly became public that your relationship with Stuart and yes, being bisexual yes. became a public issue. How yes. difficult was that to deal with? I know that was a bit of a later era, so yes, probably not as much. But was that a difficult issue for you?
Yeah, it was really difficult for me because Stuart was HIV and had been, you know, for years and years and years. And the press attacks on me inevitably filtered through to him. So that's what I found really upsetting. They chose him as a target as much as me.
Yeah, they did. Yeah,
and he
yeah.
couldn't answer back. He had no platform, if you like. So that it did make it very difficult. And for him, he couldn't really work at the time because he was too ill. So he was trapped in that, not trapped, but he was in the house, you know, with HIV, not always feeling that great, while I was, you know, flying all over the world doing this kind of, you know, I'm too sexy with my shirt stuff, you know. So that was a very unhappy time, actually.
It was very tough to balance that.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was yeah. really, really difficult. And mum cried for a year when I came out.
Dad had died a couple of years before. So mum was.
Was this news to your mum?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Oh, it's something that came out of the blue.
Yeah. All right. Our mum didn't know at all.
No. Mum would have been the sort of mum that the Craze would have had. We could do no wrong.
Yeah.
It was impossible for us to do actually any wrong at all. We could have.
My boys.
Yeah, we could have shot someone in the front room and she would have made an excuse for it.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, we could have done anything, yeah. absolutely anything.
Yeah, sure.
Dad, I think Dad had a suspicion, because I remember going for a walk with him. Yeah, I used to take the train down to see him in Whitley West Country, and then walk back with Dad to the cottage. And Dad would say things like, so this Stuart chap, what does he do for a living? Well, he's a hairdresser. right, that's tick number one. So how long have you known Stuart? Oh, about 10 years. Oh, tick number two. So where does he live? Well, he lives with me. Uh-huh. Tick number three. So gradually, so God bless Dad. I think he was sort of fishing.
Yeah.
Maybe Mum knew and she just blanked it off. She didn't, you know what I mean? She just didn't want to face it.
Said at the beginning that they had gay friends, or they had friends that you think now were probably gay. So they obviously, either they were so blind.
yes.
Or they actually didn't really want to know, and everything was okay as long as they didn't know.
I think that's what it is. You know, it's the old saying, do what you can do what you like as long as you don't frighten the horses.
Mm.
You know, I think there's an element of that about it. I think Mum and Dad, I think they had friends where they suspected something, you know, more a little unusual was going on. But I think they did the old Victorian thing, which is they just turned a blind eye. Yeah,
shake the newspaper,
light your pipe and forget it, you know.
It'll go away.
Yeah, and also the gay thing back then was very, it was quite militant, and it wasn't a very attractive thing to be gay. I mean, as part of a, you know, this gay community, which I've never believed in, but that it was a fairly, I don't know, it had a political edge to it, which made it, for some people, very, very difficult to accept. And I've always felt, same with the trans issue, I've always felt it's a personal issue. The minute you politicize it, and I know sometimes you do have to politicize it, but the minute you politicize it, it turns an awful lot of people off.
But you have, in a sense, I don't know if the words politicized it, but you've actually, when you went to Russia, I mean, you stood up
for
LGBTQ rights. You stood up and made a point, which was a very, you know, I thought that was bloody strong, because I'm not sure I'd have the guts to do what you did.
No, I mean, we didn't, I don't think we realized how aggressive it was going to be over there until we actually got knocked about.
Yeah, and when we were told, when we were invited to go and join the event, we weren't told it was a protest, a march, or anything. We just said it was an event.
Yeah.
And it was a game thing, but it was also more to do with civil liberties. The whole thing was wrapped up in that. So we wandered along, not knowing exactly what we were walking into. But also we didn't know that the mayor of Russia hadn't given it a license. So the whole thing was illegal. So we, and once we got out the van, the people carrier thing, just drove off
and left us.
Yeah,
there.
At double quick, and left us there. We were, and the press were filming these guys. They had these masks on, and it was to stop them getting AIDS. You know.
Well, I thought it was anti-pollution.
The original was pollution. Yeah. So I said, no,
how stupid am I?
I said, no, you frigging donut. It's to do with, this is an HIV thing. And they were all doing this sort of folk sort of
traditional Russian.
Yeah, but it's sort of like, yeah, whatever it
was. That'll save you from HIV.
Yeah, exactly. So when the cameras saw us, they all swung away from these Russian guys and started filming us. Yeah, Reuters and CNN and Associated Press, all those people. And this really pissed these guys off. So we started getting beaten up and hit pretty quickly after that event. I got held. Richard got smacked in the face by
some guy. I lost my glasses.
Yeah, I got held by coppers. And I don't remember at the time, but I must have got a bit of a kicking in the back, because the next day I had really bad bruising on the back of my legs and the lower back. And then because we'd worked in Russia and the East before, you can't argue with these people, because you will get a beating and the coppers won't intervene. They'll let it happen. It's not like it used to be over here. So we just said the best thing, our advice is to, advice to ourselves was to get the fuck out of there. So we grabbed our stuff and we just legged it. And it turned into a bit of a Benny Hill thing, because there was us at the front, camera crews, the blokes who wanted to beat us up. our tour manager trying to keep up with us.
Yeah.
And eventually, because we worked there a lot, we know how corrupt it is. We saw these coppers buy a burger van. And we gave them some money and we said, these blokes coming here, whack them. And they just got out their sticks and piled into them just because we paid them.
One little old lady came up to me, because I had blood on my face. One little old lady came up to me and gave me a tissue. I should never forget that.
Right, yeah, act of kindness.
Yeah, just that small act of kindness, you know, in a place experience that was fundamentally brutal. Mm. And we hid out in an Italian restaurant until our flight, very close to our flight, and I didn't feel safe until the wheels were up.
Yeah,
not really. And that we actually phoned Mum while we were in the airport, because it was all on CNN.
Yeah,
and we didn't want Mum to see it on the news before we told her, and otherwise she would have absolutely freaked. So we phoned Mum from the airport, and then ran onto the plane and kept our fingers crossed. That was it.
Have you ever been back?
Have we? We've been to, no, I don't think, we're not to Russia. No, we've been to sort of, you know, Ukraine and some of the other places, you know, but not strictly speaking to Russia, no.
No, not mainland. All the ex-Soviet bloc. We're doing, you know, Baltics and Balkans. We've done a lot of stuff there.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're mostly pretty cool, to be honest with you. Ukraine was a bit far, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Maybe it's the image we originally had with shirts off and all that sort of stuff. We don't tend to get much grief face to face.
No.
We have people, threats online and stuff like that. And a few people shouting occasionally as they drive past in the car, they'll shout, you know, Baldy, slap it, you know. But we
knew that already.
like we don't know.
Like we don't know,
yeah. We are very, very fortunate. I talk to other bands. Some bands do get quite a lot of stick. We don't get that. Most 99 times out of 100, people are nice and friendly. They want a selfie. They want to chat, particularly since the COVID thing. Overall, we've been all right. We haven't really had too much friction, have we?
No, I mean,
okay. But to come on to what I mentioned a little bit earlier, the fact that we've gone this full cycle in a way that at first seen as being, you know, by musos and the music press as being a novelty act.
Yes.
And now today, you know, as I said, well, it started with Jay-Z, I think, and then it was Taylor Swift, and now with Drake.
Yes.
The credibility is sort of seeping in.
Yes.
How does that make you feel after all these years of creating music that suddenly, you know, you're now being taken more seriously? I know you say in the UK it isn't, but it is being reported around the world.
It is.
Yes, it is.
I, I think, well, we're both obviously pleased.
Yes, great. You know, absolutely. Yes, but, and I think the Drake track, particularly, is excellent. Like, yeah. It's a really good track.
I think they've done a really, really good job. Yeah. There's an awful lot of snobbery in the music business and in the media with regards to the music business. So you'll have some artists who are continually pilloried for reasons which I don't understand, and other artists who are the flavour of the month, year in, year out, again, for reasons which I don't understand. So you just have to accept that. That's just the way it is. The press loves some people and hates other people. And, you know, if you get embroiled in that, it will give you a heart attack if you worry about it. The best thing you can do is to say, well, that's just that you hate me. That's fine. Just let it go. But there's nothing you can do about it. You know, the best thing you can do is just lead your life and say what you believe. That's, you know, there's an awful lot of co-opting going on in the business.
There's a lot of artists who are
completely co-opted by the management or by the label or the publisher or whoever. And we aren't. That's why we just pretty much say what we think.
Yeah, and we never get invited, although we've got two Ivors and three BMIs.
We never get invited anywhere.
They don't invite us anywhere. So far, I get emails from Basker. And they say, come and sit down with award-winning songwriters. And I just go back, I am an award-winning songwriter. So why don't you fuck off?
So why don't you fuck off?
And it's so bad. They have never approached us. We've never been approached by any of the schools like BIM or those people.
No.
You have these sort of, what they call these writing camps, which I think is a bit of a con, personally. Doesn't feel right, but that it's just interesting. We are very much marginalised. You know, they'll want to talk to certain writers, but if you've written Deeply Dippy and I'm Too Sexy and other songs like that, then you clearly are not someone who should be entertained.
Should be allowed to breathe. Yes, exactly.
So, how important has it been for your survival, and I mean as human beings, mental survival, not for your survival as musicians, but your survival having a brother so close and supportive on this journey? Because it feels like you've become such a close unit, and I don't know if you always were, but you know, I presume you argued as kids, but you've become such a close supportive unit that actually that is your reliance. You know, your parents aren't around and this is now the family unit. Is that true?
Yes, wasn't there a band called Corner Shop? I think we should be called Corner Shop. Really.
Yes, yes.
Because it's run like a family corner shop.
That's how
we do it. You know, I think also if you imagine, you know, Avicii and people like that who worked on their own, it can be a very lonely, lonely place if you're on your own, which is why a lot of our solo artists take their best friend with them. For some level of support. But if you're on your own, you know, you do the gig, everybody's cheering, you go back to the hotel, you're on your own, you've got the minibar, and it must be a very, very lonely place if you have nobody to bounce off. You know?
Yeah, we tend to be on the same page with most stuff, like the way we feel about certain interviews or certain working in a certain way. We tend to have, without even mentioning it, we'll both come to the same opinion.
Yeah.
We differ with music quite a lot because we have different tastes in music. So that
I've got good taste.
Yes, exactly. I've got no taste.
Fred's got no taste at all.
Yeah. But we are quite family orientated. Mum and dad, we were very close to mum and dad. And we had a good upbringing. My wife is African and she's incredibly in favor of the family unit. And so we tend to have that. We do circle the wagons and we do tend to look after each other as best we can.
And it's even more important now.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
It's even more important. I think a lot of people in the last couple of years, particularly if they're alone or if they're in a relationship that's not a happy one for whatever reason, this has been an extremely trying time. And, you know, mental issues, homelessness and all that stuff, it all goes hand in hand. So touch wood, we're very lucky.
Yeah, we are.
You know, can't be blessed.
Okay, with that in mind, right, and talking about afterwards, you're going to talk about this interview and you're going to rate me.
not at all.
No, we won't.
No, we wouldn't.
Where am I?
No, not at all.
We're fine.
Yeah, yeah. And also, we used to rely on PR people and everyone else to make these decisions for us. We stopped that a while ago.
Yeah.
We decide who we speak to and don't speak to. Yeah. We do our own research, and and it upsets people occasionally, but that's just, it is what it is.
And very often we're asked, you know, is there anything you won't talk about? And we say no. I mean, you can pretty much talk about anything.
Yeah, pretty much. We do talk about it. Yeah. I don't really like the filtering thing. We've done loads of interviews in hotels where you're around other bands and they always have a filter, always.
Yeah.
And I find that a bit tiresome. And we just, we're both a bit mouthy. We both tend to say what we think, which is why our careers have gone up and down a lot.
Yeah.
And that's just the way we are. And I can't really be bothered anymore to try and circumvent our particular, the way we say stuff. And some of my tweets have been logged at certain mainstream media outlets, because occasionally I get a little bit mouthy and, you know,
look, glass of wine.
Yeah, hey, a glass of wine. But yeah, that's, if it is what it is.
Yeah, well, I think everybody's just a little bit too uptight about almost everything.
Yeah, these days, absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
Everybody needs to chill out and, you know, the perpetual offence taking almost everything. It's a waste of time.
If
you don't like a TV program, turn it off. If you don't like a comedian, don't go. I was watching there's an American comedian called Norm Macdonald who's recently died. I think he's very, very funny. And a guy, it was filmed at a gig, and somebody, a heckler at the back, shouted out, "You're not funny. You're not being funny." Mm. And Norm Macdonald just handled it incredibly. And everybody said, "Throw him out! Throw him out!" And Norm Macdonald said, "No. Let's find out what he. Mm. Let's find out why he thinks I'm not funny." And what, you know? And it turns out the guy loves Norm Macdonald. He just wanted to, absolutely loves him. Just wanted to be heard. That's all it was.
Oh, okay.
He just wanted to be heard.
Right.
And so it's you know, you it's very important that you don't take yourself too seriously, and you just. Yeah. Just be happy in your own skin and don't expect somebody else to make you happy.
That is a brilliant sentence to end on, because
it's really true
as well. You've made me very happy today.
You're good.
You have in the past as well. And what I love about your music is the lyrics, just, you know, if we talk about I'm Too Sexy, I mean, I'm Too Sexy for My Cat. You know, some of those, they're just masterpieces in the sense that you hear it once, and you cannot not
believe
it. You know, it's just with you your whole life.
Yeah. So, when I'm singing that in front of an audience, the bit I like is "Poor Pussy, Poor Pussy Cat," because that the bird pussy gets all the girls in the front. And, you know, you've just given them that look, and it's funny. It's just funny. It's not rude. It's not. It's just fun. You know.
Yeah. It is.
Yeah. Brilliant, guys. Thanks again. Lovely, lovely to meet you, and I wish you long years of. Success, and maybe one day when you're in Germany again, I'll come and see you on tour.
Really? So, that'd be great. Cheers, mate. Thank you very much.
Up there is an interview I recommend. Down there is where you can find all the podcast interviews, and here is where you can connect.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.